These early Smith maps may in some ways look, especially to the pedantically minded critics, rather vague, and in truth, on close examination, they're not at all accurate. There are mistakes, one limestone's confused with another. Areas like the Weald, say, or the North Yorkshire Moors, are left tantalisingly blank, or coloured like rocks that don't outcrop within 50 miles. On the other hand, step back for an instant, and the three maps suddenly look utterly remarkable. They do so principally because they display a pattern, simplistically reasoned, maybe, crudely executed, surely, but a pattern that is boldly representative of the direction and outcrop of England's main clutch of middle-age sedimentary rocks, and portrayed in a way that has been confirmed time and again in the two succeeding centuries since their publication. Set a copy of a Smith map of 1801, alongside a British Geological Survey map of 1979, say, and the pattern looks just the same. The underground of the nation is shown in a broad outline that's hardly changed at all, much like the unvarying outlines of the overground. Viewed from this perspective, William Smith's first national map is quite uncannily accurate, and an astonishing achievement. Long swathes of colour sweep northeastward, up from Dorset to Yorkshire, from Portland Bill to Flamborough Head, from Bath to the Humber, displaying almost precisely where the chalk, the oolite and the Triassic marls outcrop across the heartland of England. The fact that one half-educated Oxfordshire yeoman, working alone, with compass and notebook and clinometer, and an abiding appreciation of the beauty and importance of fossils, could surmise with such accuracy what 1,000 surveyors and professional geologists have in the decades since really only succeeded in confirming, is little short of a miracle. Yet, at the same time as this triumph, the two scourges that were to afflict William Smith's life, penury and plagiarism, were beginning to signal their distant presence. Since his dismissal by the Canal Company, he had already endured nearly 2 years without formal full-time employment, although he was by now charging 2 guineas a day, and sometimes 3, for his freelance services, and so was still making a superficially decent living. But frustration, a slowly developing curse, was beginning to become the leitmotif of his existence, and the first hints were emerging that he might be rather less appreciated than his achievements seemed to warrant, that while he might well be a prophet of a brand new science, he might also be denied the full honour that prophecy generally deserves. He was first warned in May 1801 that others might be onto his ideas and might steal them away. His old friend Benjamin Richardson was the first to make his concerns known, the first to stir Smith into a brief period of literary enthusiasm. Richardson himself was first set to wondering by his colleague Joseph Townsend, who had idly remarked that he thought he himself might write a short treatise on his own huge collection of fossils. If Townsend could do such a thing, Richardson suddenly thought, then perhaps some less scrupulous men, maybe numbered among those who had been so generously sent details of Smith's thinking, might also be drawn to publishing and to stealing Smith's glory for themselves. Richardson heard that Smith was passing through Bath on one of his countless freelance excursions, found out that he was putting up at the Pack Horse in the marketplace, and penned him a hurried warning, a document that later turned out to be as prescient as its language was orotund. "My dear friend," he wrote, "to prevent the first admission of the ideas of your communication being turned to another's advantage, which, however, I cannot injure our friend the Reverend Joseph Townsend by supposing him to have entertained, I assured him before he left Bath that you had determined instantly upon giving it to the public yourself, and that you meant to publish it. It may be worth pursuing for several reasons. First, the printed proposals would secure the discovery for yourself. Secondly, it might be an eligible means of gaining time to go on progressively as your knowledge increased. Thirdly, it would make some returns for the expense of publications as you proceed. Fourthly, it would make the work most perfect." There was more in this vein, but the intention was clear. Someone, and yet most decidedly not the worthy Joseph Townsend, was on to William Smith's ideas, and might well write about them and claim them as his own. It stimulated Smith to action within the month, as we shall see. The dangers it suggested were becoming more evident by the day. It is possible to speculate at this distance that the plagiarist-in-waiting was that other Bath clergyman, fossil collector, and by all accounts colossal bore, the Reverend Richard Warner. The man had already been in hot water with the architect John Carter, who accused him of stealing a print of one of his engravings and using it without permission or acknowledgement in a book of his own. He was fined £20 and ordered to pay more than three times the fine in costs. He got into trouble with critics. Once, after writing a two-volume work of literary recollections, he was dismayed to find that a reader had himself published a 21-page monograph listing all the book's mistakes. And the printers did not smile on him either. His was the book, Topographical Remarks Relating to the Southwestern Parts of Hampshire, that was delayed by a fire at the engravers, which melted all the plates into an immense ball of copper alloy. But the Reverend Warner's History of Bath did appear in 1801, with no outward trouble hampering publication. Not a few eyebrows were swiftly raised, however, when it was noticed that the book included a copy of William Smith's Table of Strata, the document that the geologist had dictated after dinner at Townsend's house 2 years before, incorporated into Warner's book without any indication of either permission sought or payment made. Most probably Smith would not have minded. Townsend himself noted the open liberality peculiar to Mr. Smith, and recalled his desire to make so valuable a discovery universally known. And in any case, it was making him more widely known, which for any freelancer can have been no bad thing. But 10 years later still, Warner came out with another book, and with it another purloined map, this time a direct copy of the circular map of Bath that had been made by Smith in 1799. Warner had this time renamed it, inelegantly, a fossilological map of Bath and its environs. It was crude but useful, in that it showed all the local villages and, beside each name, the stratum that was most commonly evident there. It was a naked example of plagiarism. Smith, though, never complained. No doubt he found it too vulgar a creation to raise objection. He would make a very great fuss, though, in later years, when still others stole his work. "Men of scientific eminence," he would write later, famously and scathingly, in a letter to a friend, "were all pilferers of information, who saw it as their right to regard all unpublished observations as lawful plunder." In due course, 15 or so years following this first brush with a small-time plagiarist, such pilfering and plundering, though on a far grander scale than the Reverend Warner's, would help consign William Smith to debtor's prison and to years of homelessness. It would leave him embittered towards Londoners, towards the city's intellectual and social elites, and towards those in the science who, he felt, rarely ventured out of their drawing-rooms, rarely dirtied their soft pink hands, rarely muddied their fine leather boots. In 1801 he didn't see in Warner's peccadillo any indication of the sorrows to come. He was, at 32, still something of an innocent, successful and of sunny disposition, and the world seemed a kindly place. But it would not be too long before all this would change. He was by now fast building up an impressive circle of friends, and was winning commissions that would take him clear across the British Isles, satisfying his goading urge to travel, to keep moving. The Bath Agricultural Society was the key. Its membership reflected the extraordinary reputation of the region for comfort, beauty, wealth, and style, and it exposed Smith to a range of men of money, leisure, divinity, and science, as well as to men of the same kind of rudely practical bent as himself. Each group of men was peculiarly useful to him. The gentlemen amateurs, the fossil collectors, and the natural philosophers, who invited him to their vicarages and country cottages, encouraged him in his studies and helped him with his ideas. The practical men, the coal borers and drainage engineers and well sinkers he met, taught him new techniques and allowed him to make the best use of his time in the field. But it was really the aristocrats, the members of the landed gentry, who at this stage in his life were to provide him with both the work and an entree into an ever-widening network of influence. There now came a sudden acceleration in William Smith's ambitions and desires, and central to this change were the brief friendships he enjoyed with three famous men of the day: Thomas Coke of Holkham, the Duke of Bedford, and Sir Joseph Banks. Considering Smith's later belief, when he was imprisoned and in trouble, it was the English aristocracy that had treated him badly, and that his humble beginnings had counted heavily against him in a society so class-obsessed as 19th-century England, it has to be remembered that the nobility assisted mightily in bringing his early ideas to fruition. His early sponsors were indeed members of the English upper class, writ large. The chain of introductions to these sponsors was brought about by way of Smith's unusual expertise not with rocks or fossils, but with water. Canals, with which Smith now had a good deal of experience, are essentially enormous and elongated repositories of water. They are not rivers. The water in them doesn't have a natural source, doesn't flow from one end to the other, and is not continually refreshed from a spring. All is artifice, a complex and cumbersome arrangement of planning and engineering that allows a very large body of water to exist in a series of deep horizontal chambers, along which vessels may glide, passing uphill and downhill by way of long cascades of locks, in order to move goods or people, or to undertake commerce. It's central to the design of any canal that it retain its water as best it can, since water is costly, and has to be brought into the canal from rivers or lakes, or from purpose-built reservoirs. Smith came to know very well, almost uncannily, so said his admirers, just how to route a canal so that it lost as little water as possible. He saw to it that wherever practicable, it passed over beds of impermeable rock, and in those places where it didn't, that its bed and banks were lined and proofed, so that the water standing inside stayed just where it was. In accumulating what would later become his nationally known expertise in keeping water where it needed to be, and removing it from where it shouldn't be, William Smith came into sudden demand by farmers, who saw in this skill a way for them to turn their profitless marshes into workable farmland. Up to this point he had been known best for his skills as a surveyor and a cartographer. Now he was changing, chameleon-like, with the addition of this new and very marketable skill into the unglamorous, but to post-enclosure England, essential figure of a drainage engineer. Recognition of his growing mastery was one reason why the chairman of the canal company, James Stevens, had in 1799 hired Smith to help him drain his own farmland. No matter that Stevens had fired Smith from the canal that very June, so bad was the rainfall that autumn, and so uselessly boggy did the Stevens family farm become, and so in need of employment was Smith himself, that a deal was struck, in which Smith was paid to drain, dredge, and dike the Stevens fields for the highly respectable rate of 2 or even sometimes 3 guineas a day. And Smith, clearly burying his pride, worked well. The Stevens farm was promptly drained, any number of cuts and culverts were made, and pipes and bores laid, and the farmland was made ideally suited for agriculture for years to come. This was the time of the improving farmer, of the agriculturist who, now that the Enclosure Acts had brought some sanity to the fields of England, was intent on making as much as possible from the land he worked, by using newfangled fertilizers, by mixing soils, by judicious draining projects, by breeding new strains, and by sculpting the land and creating new environments. Thomas Crook, a typical improving farmer of the day, who lived in the Wiltshire village of Titherington, saw what Smith had done to the Stevens farm nearby, and he hired Smith to do much the same for him a year later. And then, once the drainage work was successfully completed, Crook invited for an inspection tour the man who is quite probably still regarded as the greatest agriculturist of his or of any age, Thomas William Coke of Holkham, or as the Prince Regent later liked to have him known, since Coke took the title with great reluctance, the Earl of Leicester. For Smith, the meeting with Coke presented an opportunity of inestimable value. Coke of Holkham, as he was generally known, was a man with initially no practical knowledge of farming. He simply owned farms, placed tenants in them, and lived off the rental income. But in 1788 one of his tenants refused to renew his lease, and Coke decided that, rather than let the land lie fallow, he'd make an attempt to farm it himself. Since he knew so little, he took the radical step of organizing a huge seminar, which he called a sheep-shearing, and to which he invited all the local farmers and practical men and landowners, so that they could inspect his land, crops, and livestock, and make recommendations. The event was enormously useful to him, and since he laid on huge lunches and dinners and had experts offer speeches and demonstrations, great fun for all of those who came. In due course his own farm flourished. He experimented with new soils and fertilizers. He replaced the normal Norfolk crop of rye with wheat. He decided to buy and crossbreed sheep, and to introduce into his fields large numbers of sturdy, fat, wool-covered animals that would replace the scrawny, dog-like specimens with which Norfolk was then usually populated. He bred Suffolk pigs with Neapolitans, and within 2 years was producing massive porkers that delighted markets and trenchermen alike. The sheep-shearings, known across the land, and eventually through much of farming Europe, as Coke's clippings, became hugely popular. One of them, held in the early summer of 1818, attracted 7,000 people, with Coke offering hospitality to more than 600 in Holkham Hall, no matter what their rank, station, or nationality. Thomas Coke's reputation rests today largely on the outward appearance of his great farms, and on the now widespread knowledge of his techniques of breeding and feeding. What is not so often recalled about Coke, or indeed about any of the other great improving farmers of the day, is that almost all these men, before they sowed a single seed or bred a single animal, had first to prepare their lands. Before the Enclosure Acts, English land was in a hopeless mess. Unfarmed, the newly enclosed fields were still merely boggy patchworks of mud and sedge, with barely any meadows suitable for workers to work them with ploughs and seed drills. Very few of the new estates were unencumbered by piles of rocks or clumps of trees. Fewer still, more important, were properly drained. The Enclosure Acts changed all that by prompting the newly empowered owners to recognise the need for efficiency and careful husbandry, to come to grips with their individual agricultural shortcomings, and to begin shaping the tidy and mannered English countryside that we see today. Fields laid out neatly, sedge trimmed back, bogs all drained. The fact that all is so impeccably and memorably attractive today stems in great part from the work of men like William Smith, who were called in by landowners like Coke to change out of all recognition the appearance of their vast acreages. William Smith was called into Holkham specifically because the work there was difficult, and because he had evidently been so successful in performing drainage work on the canal, as well as for Stevens and for Crook. In Norfolk he was asked to dry out the huge flat fields that stood beside the North Sea shore, to make productive the salt marshes that lay behind the dunes, to channel a network of wayward rivers, to dredge and drain and otherwise hydraulically improve the lands. His work remains intact today. Hundreds of adequately dry and highly productive flatland acres that surround what is now recognised as one of England's most enchanting stately homes. A year after Smith had accepted this commission, and at about the time he was colouring his geological discoveries on the Carey maps of England, Thomas Coke introduced him to one of those figures of whom Lloyd George was later to be so rudely disapproving, the vastly wealthy and hugely influential Francis Russell, the 5th Duke of Bedford. Deficient in wit and imagination, though he may have been regarded by Emma Louise Radford, who wrote his entry in the Dictionary of National Biography, the Duke was a great agriculturist, and his enormous estates at Woburn, now a 3,000-acre deer park for tourists with 9 species of especially adorable animals, were made into a model farm along Coke's lines and supported vast herds of cattle and flocks of sheep. The Duke of Bedford's 4-day sheep shearings were so popular as to make even those at Holkham look like village fetes. Thousands came, and there were ploughing contests and cattle sales, wool auctions and dances, and banquets for many more hundreds than even the Earl of Leicester could afford. "To see a prince of the blood royal and many great lords sit down to the same table," wrote Arthur Young, one of those who went, "and partake of the conversation of the farmer and the breeder, to see all animated in the spirit of improvement and listening with delight to the favoured topic of the plough, is a spectacle worthy of Britain, and in her blessed isle alone to be beheld." A suitably massive oil painting survives by the noted animal artist George Garrard of the great shearing held at Woburn in 1804. Partly a record, partly an allegory, it shows 88 agricultural personalities grouped around the base of a massive limestone column capped by the Ship of Commerce. The Duke is there, top-hatted, and suitable to both his gravitas and dignitas, the only figure there on a horse. Around him are the great and the good of the English rural universe, smocked farmers and shepherds, impeccably dressed gentleman farmers, roughly dressed blacksmiths and farriers, men fat and thin, jolly and severe, ill-born and noble, of practical or professional appearance, all busy in conversation, or gazing in rapt attention at the tups being shorn in a pen before them, or at the elongate cattle standing patiently at centre stage. Garrard's painting seems to show that, despite this being June, the shearing was held on a wild and cloudy day. The buildings in the background are severe and practical, all stables, byres and dairies, and none of the Inigo Jones-designed masterpieces, in which His Grace the Duke lived, as a lifelong bachelor, visible. To judge by the trees alone, it is a very English painting. One of them is an age-gnarled oak, perhaps the very tree which still stands at Woburn to this day, where a Cistercian abbot, one Hobbes, was hanged in the 16th century for making, according to the court records, treasonable utterances against the king. It was his supposed crime that led to Woburn Abbey being confiscated and handed to the determinedly Protestant Russell family, which has lived there ever since. Of such events, William Smith may have thought, has England's aristocracy been made. For Smith was there, and he's included both in Garrard's painting and in an aquatint engraving the artist made 7 years later. He's only barely discernible, however, still regarded evidently as only a peripheral member of the ducal elite. He's just visible on the picture's upper left, amid a crowd of others of equal honour and distinction. A bluff-looking man of middle height, wearing a black, broad-brimmed hat, looking away, barely recognisable. The artist helps by providing us with a key. His figure is shown as number 10, against which is written the simple and almost vaguely insulting rubric, "Damnation with the faintest of praise." "Mr. Smith," says the note, "the drainer." Matters of rank and propriety probably meant little enough to Smith at this stage in his career. He was as close to nobility and power as an Oxfordshire countryman could expect to be, and besides, the links he had forged in the brief time since his removal from the Canal Company, from James Stevens to Thomas Crook, from Thomas Coke to the Duke of Bedford, were proving both profitable and, as it happened, enormously useful. Moreover, further links in the chain were to be forged through his passing acquaintance with the Duke. Not only did he meet and present his card, William Smith, surveyor and drainer, it said, to still more noblemen like the Duke of Manchester, the Earl of Thanet, and the Lords Talbot and Somerville, but he also engaged his first apprentice, the first man who became a geologist as a direct result of working for Smith. This was the Duke of Bedford's land steward, John Fairy, a figure who would champion his mentor's work, play a vitally important role in his affairs, and lead him still further into a world of influence and connection that would enable him finally to produce and present the great map that would render him famous. The story of John Fairy, and his own introduction of Smith to one further world-renowned figure, who would become the map's greatest and most influential patron, belongs properly a little later in this tale, except in one respect. For when the two men first met, at Woburn in October 1801, William Smith had something to show him. Benjamin Richardson's stern warning, that if Smith didn't begin committing his thoughts to paper, someone else would beat him to it, had apparently sunk in. He had indeed embarked on the publication of his ideas. He had accepted the good doctor's advice not to publish merely a new map or a list of strata like the one he had dictated at Pulteney Street, or even a cross-sectional portrait of the English underground, but a proper book. And so on June the 1st, barely 2 weeks after receiving Richardson's letter, Smith surprised and delighted everyone by publishing a document, a 4-page prospectus for the book he was now determined to write. It had a title that, back at the beginning of the century, might have sounded more tempting than it does today. Accurate delineations and descriptions of the natural order of the various strata that are found in different parts of England and Wales, with practical observations thereon. there was in the prospectus a closely formulated financial model. 2,000 copies of the final book would be printed, and they would be sold at 2 guineas each, with Smith taking a 50% cut of the expected profits of £3,200. The prospectus, which Smith showed to an impressed John Ferry in 1801, was a suitably handsome creation. Printed in Covent Garden, it was ambitious enough to include a stratigraphically apposite epigraph from Alexander Pope. All nature is but art, unknown to thee, all chance, direction, which thou canst not see. The hope was that those who saw the elegant little document would be seized with a burning desire to own the eventual book. And it seemed at first to have the required effect. Letters rained in, all enthusiastically asking to be put on the list. "I've distributed your prospectus amongst my friends," wrote one Richard Gregory from Coole in Ireland, quite typically, "and I've the pleasure to request you will add to the list of your subscribers the name of my father, Robert Gregory, of 56 Berners Street, London, and the Honourable Richard Trench, MP, Spring Garden Terrace, London." Smith had a publisher all lined up, and supposedly one of the best. He was John Debrett, who had already made his name, and might well have made a fortune as the most noted cataloguer of the peers of the realm. He was Piccadilly's most celebrated Whiggish biographer, a man curiously obsessed with publishing books about Australia, and by all accounts an amusing and unreconstructed snob. So everything thus far seemed set. Even the normally cautious Dr. Richardson appeared delighted, and he wrote an overjoyed letter to his young friend, a letter that reminds us today both of the antiquity of the moment and of the lingering hostility and suspicion felt towards France so soon after the fall of Napoleon. Richardson advises Smith to take Debrett's opinion on the propriety of giving an edition of the work in Latin for the benefit of all Europe, to be circulated under the patronage of our foreign envoys, etc., etc. This would give the system its due importance and prevent any pirated French edition which the world would be ready enough to catch at. But Debrett, who might well have made a fortune, was not to do so with this particular volume. His own finances, spiralling out of control, turned out to be the cardinal problem, both for the firm itself and, rather more ominously, for William Smith. For though the celebrated Debrett's Peerage was soon to become a reference book of biblical standing among the aristocracy, and always regarded as a considerably more venerable text than its rather arriviste rival, Burke's, John Debrett himself was not the man to make money from it, nor indeed from any of his publishing ventures. He was described simply as a kindly, good-natured man, but without business aptitude, and he lived well only because of monies inherited by his wife. He went bankrupt twice. The entire project, along with many others in which he was involved, was soon mired in crisis. Smith himself set to work with a vengeance. "I've just come off a long and troublesome journey through Somerset, South and North Wales, Chester and Lincolnshire, a distance of about 800 miles, he wrote to Debrett from Woburn 6 months after issuing the prospectus. "I have scarce had time to sit still, write or rest for the last 5 weeks, but have picked up much new matter and confirmed some of the old, and collected the following list of subscribers along the way: R. Cornfield, Dr. Beals, Mr. John Grant, 3 copies, Mr. William James of Bristol," he names a further 15 potential purchasers, including a surveyor named Jeremiah Cruz, with whom he would soon go into business. "It was my intention to come to London almost immediately, but the Duke of Bedford has been making such appointments for me in Ireland that I must attend to." But soon John Debrett was making it clear that Smith did not have a prayer of making anything like the £1,600 he had so naively anticipated. Smith was disillusioned and devastated. He sent Debrett an understandably churlish note. "A work of public utility which has engaged 12 or 14 years of the best part of a man's life in the most laborious train of thought and observation ought to close up the past prospect with plenty. Remote expectations will not satisfy me any longer. I am certainly under no obligation to lay before the public the fruits of my labours, and unless I can be satisfied of an adequate reward, I cannot think of giving up more of my time." Although money was the most visible problem in the making of the book, it was not the only one. Smith's lack of literary confidence contributed to, as did his curious indecisiveness, his seemingly pathological need to procrastinate. It was to become a lifelong affliction. On some days he'd decide to abandon the whole affair, making little progress from not being able to please myself in the mode of expressing my thoughts, he confided to his diary, and from foreseeing great difficulty in arranging such matters for a book, and also from considering that I was losing 2 guineas a day for the chance of a small profit by the book, I wisely decided to stick to my profession. Yet on other days he would seem re-energized, eager to start afresh. In May 1802, for example, we find pages from his day-book recording a number of small victories over his indecision. Tuesday, May 11th, wrote several pages on the formation of the strata and the effects of the deluge, etc. Wednesday, May the 12th, collecting together loose memorandums, writing several small pages. Saturday, May 15th, considering about plates to be engraved, looking over and sorting out maps. Sunday, May 16th, after breakfast, wrote 18 pages of observations. Yet it was not to be. The relationship between Smith and Debrett deteriorated fast, with the geologist asking far too much, the publisher offering far too little, the project becoming subject to interminable delays and snared in arguments between the pair. In the end, it was the money that did for it. Smith went bankrupt in 1802, and then again in 1804, and Smith's hopes of having his work offered between hardcovers to his enormous list of subscribers, or indeed to the public at large, swiftly died. The book was never to appear, and Smith was not to write anything of geological importance for nearly a decade. But the setback then seems to have infused him with a new but very different sense of purpose. Although he had been forced to abandon his writing, his new circumstances served to provoke him into a new frenzy of travel. All of a sudden he was accepting commissions throughout the length and breadth of the country, Norfolk one week, Dorset the next, Yorkshire today, Shropshire tomorrow, and with the Duke of Bedford's ready help, Ireland too. He began a period of intense restlessness, burning up the stagecoach miles like a travelling salesman, seeking out the work and at the same time seeking out the rocks and fossils that unrolled and unravelled themselves before him. The notion of publishing something still nagged persistently at him, like an aching tooth. Maybe it should be a book, or maybe it should be something far grander, far more ambitious. Maybe some document that demanded less intellectual energy, less cerebration, but that could perhaps emerge as a direct consequence of all his wandering, his collecting, his fieldwork, his observing. Maybe, if it was not to be a book, then it could and should be a truly wonderful, majestic, and all-encompassing map. And thus, by circumstantial happenstance, was the plan for the great map formally conceived. It was an idea that had nudged at him for years, ever since those first youthful attempts in Bath. The maps he had made in those early days were rudimentary enough, either devoted only to discrete localities, or performed over a larger scale with a broad-brush vagueness that made them relatively simple to complete. But now it began to seem to him that a grander, more ambitious map could properly memorialize him, a map of the whole country, closely detailed and highly accurate. This new map, he thought, would reflect in so much more appropriate a manner than a book his special talents. To make such a thing, though, would require a great deal of time and a lot of money. And so he set about to gather the funds and rally yet more public support for this new project, and at the same time accelerated once more his determined wanderings. He travelled on commission, draining, surveying, mapping, and gathering as he did so yet more and more information. "I intend to come through a part of Hampshire on my way westward," he wrote to one Samuel Collett in May 1802, "for the purpose of seeing a few places where the chalks and clay strata turn round the end of your hills. And to Richardson, back home in Bath, I've collected a great deal from the north of England and Scotland. Our Mendip limestone, with St. Cuthbert's bead, goes out to sea at Holy Island, where they are found in great plenty, and are called by this name from the saint of the island. I found fossils in Red Marl of Staffordshire, connected some limestones, and nearly connected some ranges of the coals." It was all information that would soon enable him to sketch in his mind, and with steadily accumulating detail, an outline of what he now surely wanted to produce, a definitive portrait of the immensely complicated arrangements of the strata, a chart of the underworld of his country. A Jurassic Interlude. On early summer Saturdays in the 1950s, when the weather was fine, the Sisters of the Blessed Order of the Visitation liked nothing more than to take their little convent boys swimming in the sea. To keep us more biddable, they tried to tire us out by walking the entire way, taking us up and over the little range of steep Jurassic hills that lay between school and the beach. I think that none of us appreciated much of the geology at the time, and nor, I dare say, did the nuns, but we all knew that the landscape it formed was unusual and very beautiful. And although my own memories of those long, long walks have been more than a little coloured by the harshness of the boarding school regime, I was 6½, and the punishment for my frequent dawdling on Saturday walks was 6 strokes on the hand with a bamboo cane and a big wooden spoonful of castor oil forced down my throat by an unusually ugly sister who sported a luxuriant blonde moustache, there are delights about it that linger yet. There was a simple routine to the excursions. We would set out from our convent in the old rope-making town of Bridport in Dorset, and walk for a while beside the main road that took westbound travellers on towards Devon and Cornwall. A mile or so out, and we reached a village called Eep, where we'd turn south and stop to rest and play games on a sloping meadow that was thick with ferns and yellow gorse. Then we'd plunge off again uphill, into a rabbit warren of steep lanes that had been carved into small canyons of a honey-coloured sandstone, and that were concealed from the landscape beyond by hedges 6 feet high, with a feel about them like front-line trenches, that of course we, as brutish little boys, very much liked. Occasionally there'd be a 5-barred field gate, and through it tantalising glimpses of stands of rolling wheat, warm and golden in the early summer sun. The roadway in these lanes would be littered with small pieces of rock that had broken from the canyon walls. We would kick them around, imagining them to be grenades or spare ammo, and we'd scuff our shoe leather white on their sharp edges until a disapproving escort nun wagged her finger and reminded us of the probability of public punishment in the school refectory the next morning. The list of offences fit for the caning and castor oil routine was very long. After 15 minutes of the slope, that had us puffing and panting upward, the road flattened and widened, the canyon walls fell away, the summit meadows appeared, and ahead was the vision that we had all awaited, the sun-dappled, hammered pewter surface of the English Channel, the sea. Up here there always seemed to be a cool onshore breeze blowing up and over the summit. It was tangy with salt and seaweed, and the way it cooled the perspiration was so blessed a feeling that we would race downhill into it with wing-wide arms, and it would muss our hair and tear at our uniform caps, and we'd fly down towards the beach into the surging channel waves that chewed back and forth across the pebbles and the sand. I seem to remember that by this point in the weekly expedition, the dozen or so of us, all called by numbers, since the convent's peculiar regime forbade the use of names, I was simply 46, were well beyond caring what the nuns might think. The ocean was by now far too magnetic a temptation. Once in a while we might glance back at them as they stood, black and hooded like carrion crows, fingering their rosaries and muttering prayers or imprecations, but if they disapproved of us tearing off our grey uniforms and plunging headlong into the surf, so what? This was summer, here was the sea, and we were schoolboys, a combination of forces that even these storm-troopers of the Blessed Visitation could not overwhelm. So we stripped down to our trunks, we paddled, we swam, we splashed and fooled around in the green water and spray for what seemed hours, shouting ourselves hoarse, forgetting everything in our careless summer delirium. And then, all too quickly, the heat of the day fell away, and it became late afternoon. The sun was suddenly lower, the shadows longer, and in the sea breeze was the first indication of the evening chill, prompting the occasional shiver and excited comparisons of goose pimples. The sea would be enveloped in a pale purple haze. By now, all weary from swimming, we'd retreat some yards from the seaside and begin to play in the still warm sand. We'd build castles, collect starfishes or dogfish egg sacs or shells, or bury one another in tombs that would fill coldly in the slow rising tide. It was during one of these lazy, after-swimming reveries that I found my first Jurassic fossil. It was an ammonite, coiled in repose like a small and fat spiral spring, the relic of a shell that the textbook said once held a squid-like animal that could pulse its way slowly and silently backward through the warm and life-rich seas of the time. Although I've long since lost it, I remember it only too well. In my mind now it seems a much-loved talisman of those curiously contented days. The fossil was a smooth, reddish, circular object that sat nicely in the palm of my hand, weighing perhaps a quarter of a pound. It was smooth enough, I thought at first, to be used as a skimmer on the flat surface of the sea. It was almost perfectly whole, not much bigger than an old English penny piece, maybe an inch and a half across, and in comparison with other ammonites I had seen in museums, it seemed to have almost no coils at all. Its circumference was simply a circle that folded into itself and then vanished. In its centre was a small whorl, and its flanks were traced with sinuous lines, presumably marks that showed how its shell grew, season by season or day by day. I gazed closely at it, enraptured by its strange delicacy. I licked it to remove some of the sand, and used a fingernail to try, unsuccessfully, to pry away small concretions. These would yield only to the point of a nail file later in the evening. A few of the other boys seemed interested. I remember still that numbers 6 and 25 in particular had shared my fascination and had asked to have a closer look. The beast evidently left as much of an impression on them. Many years later I came across number 25. By then he had a name and was a senior partner in a private banking firm, while walking along Connaught Road in Hong Kong. It was during an evening of reminiscence, some while later, that he asked me if I still had that pretty little ammonite. But no, I said shamefacedly, I didn't, and neither of us could remember much more about the day it was found, nor to our greater shame could we remember what Six, the other boy who had liked it, was really called. All this I may have lost or forgotten, but I still remember exactly where I found the fossil, and, knowing that William Smith had been to the very place himself, sometime during the 15 years that he wandered around England, exploring and making ready the details of his great map, I decided that I had to go back there. I thought it would be helpful to make my own brief tour of the Jurassic, to follow the outcrop of England's most distinctive raft of rocks, just as Smith had done, from coast to coast, all the way up to Yorkshire, from down here among my school memories, in the magic depths of South Dorset. Maybe by doing so I'd come to learn a little more, learn not simply about the topography of Middle England, nor of the lithologies of the Middle Jurassic, nor even of the paleogeography of the area, but about William Smith himself. Perhaps if I took the journey he had, I might gain some clue as to the extent of his achievement. And though I'd never quite feel it as he had done, I'd never quite know the discomfort of bouncing in a springless chaise on a rock-strewn turnpike, or suffer the cold comforts of a windy coaching inn, or the misery of arguments with an under-tipped ostler, still I might come to feel just a little as he had done all those years ago. And I had it in mind that, despite the newness of all that now rose on top of the landscape, despite the motorways and power pylons and cell phone masts, the new cities and new towns and the forests of skyscrapers and suspension bridges, and landmarks that had been built in styles and for reasons that could barely have been imagined 2 centuries before, there would be something about the outcrop of the period that would be discernible still. The imprint of geology has an immense power over landscape. The imprint on England of the Middle Jurassic would, I imagined, still be there, underlying everything, imperturbable, immovable, and quite probably, just as in William Smith's time, instantly recognisable. Down at the starting point, 40 years on, and the village of Ypres still looked much the same. The main road was a divided highway now, with traffic thundering endlessly to and fro along it, and not a line of schoolchildren, who would have been in great peril from the frantic lorries, anywhere to be seen. The lanes at the top of the downs were just the same, though, sleepily unpopulated, and incised into the sandstone so deeply that one still half expected duckboards and mud, and the thud of wartime shellfire. and then, from on top of the hill, sighing and slumbering below, was the English Channel, just as it always must have been, a soft, surging sound on the gravel shore, and with distant ships crawling along its steel-grey surface, silhouetted in the southern summer sun. I walked down to the beach, and, remembering just where I'd found the little fossil, turned promptly left to walk the few hundred yards to where I might, I fancied, discover another. In turning left, I was now facing east. A map would show something of a geography that my years in Dorset had allowed me to know quite instinctively. The counties of Devon and Cornwall ranged behind me. Brittany was invisible a long way off across the sea to my right. The rich farming valleys of Thomas Hardy's Dorset were up above me, where I had come from, to my left. And most significantly, to any seeker after geological truth, unseen but very clearly marked on any map, the white cliffs of Dover lay 100 miles away, directly ahead. And in that single topographic fact is a clear and present indication of the simple existence of geologic time. The white Dover cliffs are made of chalk, which is the best-known rock of a period that, identified by the fossils it contains, has long been known as the Cretaceous. The rocks here in this part of Dorset, on the other hand, were all, and have been similarly identified by another group of very different fossils, laid down during the period known as the Jurassic. For anyone today to walk eastward from Dorset to Dover along this coastline, just as William Smith had walked eastward along the Somerset Coal Canal from Dunkerton to Limpley Stoke some 2 centuries before, is to walk forward in geological time, is to walk away from and out of the older rocks, and towards and into the newer. The cliffs that ranged before me now were each made of rocks that were successively younger than those in the cliffs that ranged behind me. The more distantly ahead of me they ranged, the younger and the younger they became, so that those lost in the shimmering haze of the afternoon belonged to whole stages and epochs of geological time that were far more recent than those beside and behind me. It was the gentle and uniform southeasterly dip of all these outcropping rocks that made this possible. Had the rocks not dipped at all, but remained horizontal all the way along the coast, the outcrop would be entirely the same, the topography unchanged, the crops above and the view below unchanged from Dorset to Kent. It was the dip that allowed the history of the underworld to be on such dramatic display, the same gentle and uniform dip that had made all this history so suddenly clear to William Smith in the hills and valleys around Bath. As the cliffs rose and fell in ranks along the coast in front of me, I could see with consummate ease exactly how each one, because of the bread-and-butter arrangement of its rocks, was geologically different from another. Here beside me the cliff might be made of a Jurassic sandstone capped by a limestone, but 2 miles further eastward down the coast the same limestone that here was on top and formed the cliff's cap might well form the base of the next range of cliffs. Layered on top of it, there'd be other rocks, shales maybe, or marls, clays, ironstones, perhaps more limestones, perhaps more sandstones, and with each stratum on top younger and younger than those below, until 100 miles away, way past the counties of Hampshire and Sussex, and well beyond the towns of Bournemouth and Southampton, beyond Brighton and Eastbourne, and the great promontory of Beachy Head, there would be the white cliffs themselves, the chalk. The rocks in Kent could be shown by their fossils to belong not merely to a younger geological stage or a younger epoch than those back in Dorset. They'd belong to an entire geological period, the Cretaceous, that was a full 50 million years younger than these Jurassic rocks that stood beside me. To cross the southern coast of England, west to east, is thus to travel forward, and at breathtaking chronological speed, in a sort of self-propelled time machine. With every few 100 yards of eastward progress, one passes through hundreds of thousands of years of geologic time. 1 million years of history go by with every couple of miles of march. Here, in this particular corner of Dorset, at the coastline by the tiny port of West Bay, which is where we as schoolboys frolicked in the sea, one huge cliff made of sandstone and topped by a cap of limestone dominates all the scenery. It stood to the east of the tiny harbour, and was known, somewhat unimaginatively, as East Cliff. And it was exactly here, cold and swim-weary, back in the 1950s, that I found that first ammonite. Some 40 years on, and I had walked down to the sea once more, and I had turned to face eastward, and the self-same cliff rose dramatically beside me. It looked quite unchanged, solemn, brooding and immense. I walked over to its base, past the bundled-up vacationers and the few pet walkers braving the late spring chill. In part, I hoped I might find another fossil. Mainly, though, I just wanted to gaze up at what must have enthralled William Smith as he contemplated the beginning of his 15-year map-making tour, as he reached the starting point of his thousands of miles of trekking along and across the outcrop of the English Jurassic. Eastcliff rose up in a great domed cathedral curve, rising from where two small streams had eroded it down to sea level on its western and eastern ends. At its centre it was maybe 130 feet high, vertiginous and quite sheer. Its face was composed of thin bands of a hard calcareous sandstone that alternated with thicker bands of an orange-brown rock that was much softer and more easily weathered. From afar this gave the whole cliff a quite dramatically striped appearance, with the stripes all sloping gently to the east along the dip of the outcrop. The layers of sandstone progressively thinned higher up on the cliff face, until at the very top there suddenly seemed to be a layer of a rather different rock, a thick band of a mustard-coloured limestone that overhung the rest of the cliff and had evidently proved alarmingly dangerous to whoever farmed or walked or played golf on the meadowland at the top. Chunks of this rock lay littered below on the beach, showing where either human beings had deliberately knocked over hanging blocks of it down from the summit, or where erosion had caused it to tumble. It was from within the shattered remains of a huge boulder of this particular rock that I had found my polished-looking ammonite all those years ago. Now, nearly half a century on, I looked for another. I looked long and hard, but after an hour or so admitted defeat. I couldn't find one anywhere, although I did find one or two fragments of very different-looking specimens, bits of ammonites that didn't look polished at all, and which, to judge from the sandy limestone particles adhering to them, seemed to have fallen from some of the bands of the rock lower down the cliff face. In finding these, I was reminded of the long debates we used to have in our Oxford paleontology classes about whether smooth-skinned ammonites, with their decidedly streamlined appearance, could swim any faster than those that had more ornamentation and roughness about them. The general belief was that it made no difference, and that an ammonite, no speed demon at the best of times, lived its life bobbing near the surface of the sea, and using the arms that hung from its backward-facing aperture merely to rock itself gently back and forth, to grab hold of passing morsels of food, and stuff them into its jaws, where they were roughly dealt with, chewed up, and passed on into the digestive tract. Nonetheless, the guidebooks I had with me on my second visit readily identified that first ammonite. The smooth-skinned cephalopod turned out to have been a fine example, how I wished now that I had managed to hold on to mine, of Lyoceros opalinum, a creature that defines by its very presence a junction point of immense importance within the English Jurassic. The rocks that customarily lie immediately below what's called eponymously the opalinum zone belong to the upper part of the epoch known as the Lias, and which itself is chronologically a part of the lower part of the geological period known as the Jurassic. Then again, those rocks that occur, or at least occur in this part of the world, immediately above where this fossil is to be found, belong to a formation called the Inferior Oolite, and that lies within the epoch generally known as the Middle Jurassic. Lyoceros opalinum, the small, smooth, reddish disc of the ammonite I'd once held, thus forms the boundary marker between the lower and the middle Jurassic, or between what's known as the Lias and the Dogger. This smooth-skinned ammonite, the palm-handy stone I'd once contemplated skimming across the surface of the channel, records one long instant of faraway time. It was an instant that can be proved, by the radiochemical techniques that have so advanced the business of chronostratigraphy, to have passed more or less exactly 178 million years ago. The fossil that I had once held in my almost seven-year-old hands was one of the most powerful keys that would unlock the secrets of Jurassic time. Lyoceros opalinum, indeed, was a fossil, one of very, very many in his collection, that William Smith, with his theory of fossil uniqueness, would come to know very well indeed. It was a great shame that I had lost it. I would have liked to have carried a specimen with me as talisman, yet, try as I might, I couldn't find a replacement. To have discovered one would have been ideal, and yet my memory of that first one remains comfortably powerful enough. As I walked back up the cliff to the parked car, it occurred to me that my hero and I were now subtly connected by this single small lozenge of limestone and calcite, by the smooth and silkily beautiful physical object that he had once held in his hands, much as I had done all those years later. To Smith back then, and to countless other inquiring collectors since, the little fossil was very much more than simply a four-ounce reminder that tropical oceans had existed in the England of 178 million years ago. It was a symbol also of the beguiling magic and mystery of the science of modern geology, and it provided a cosy link between the past and the present, between the extremes of the ultra-modern and the ultra-ancient. The Carboniferous period in Britain, which began 360 million years ago, was generally a very lively time. It was an age characterized by torrid wet heat, by shallow seas and endless swamp, by thick rainforests crawling with slimy amphibians, a time of huge dragonflies and tall ferns, of warm deltas with pools that supported trilobites and shellfish. And then, with what can only be described as a fit of geological suddenness, everything changed, and all the life that was richly abundant dwindled to nothing, mysteriously withered away. In the Permian and Triassic periods, what is now the continent of Europe was dominated by endless sandy wastes, blasted by hot, dry winds. Lifelessness, aridity, and blistering heat suddenly took the place of all that carboniferous moisture and fecundity. There's an explanation for all this, an answer satisfactory to all who have wondered, and that's only been newly found buried in the arcane complications of plate tectonics. The early world was a terrifyingly volatile place. It was always mobile, its crustal blocks caught up in violent swirls of ferocious movement. It now seems clear that during the Permian, one of these immense million-year-long swirls saw to it that all the proto-continents were briefly fused together. Yet again, they had been fused many times before. In doing so this time, they formed the now familiar supermass known as Pangaea, the continent that was the true beginning of earthly everything. There were very few internal seas within Pangaea. Such oceans as existed in Permian times lay principally at the peripheries of this giant landmass. Within, arid and windswept, were huge plains and mountain ranges and salt flats, either bitterly cold or raging with heat. Mongolia, the northern Chinese plains, the Bolivian Altiplano, the Arizona desert, all of these look today as the corner of Pangaea that would ultimately form Britain, must have looked in Permian times, hot, dry, and very stable. Except with terrifying suddenness, another series of massive convulsions then broke out. The oceans roared back in to inundate the plains. It must have been the almightiest of spectacles, much as if the South Pacific were to rise today, to flood all of China except its highest peaks, and then to lap hungrily away at, and eventually flood to great depth, the immensity of the Gobi Desert. And with the water came life, which burst forth once more and was soon teeming in wild profusion. These warm oceans were benign and fertile again, and filled with living creatures, living marine beasts that, much more significantly for today's geologists, died. Over the millennia, the skeletons of thousands of species of their occupants, ammonites to belemnites, brachiopods to oysters, ichthyosaurs and plesiosaurs, rained down to lie in vast thicknesses on the ocean floor below. In the jungles there were dinosaurs, as well as scores of types of early birds and dozens of strange creatures that had evidently crawled up from the ocean and out of the freshwater ooze, and that had readily joined in the battles for territorial supremacy. The record of this sudden new explosion of life remains today firmly locked in the limestones and the shales and sandstones of the Jurassic. Fossils are everywhere in the thick masses of Jurassic strata, attesting to an abundance that's the very opposite of the lifeless tedium of the Permian. And no matter that the name Jurassic itself comes from the Jura Mountains of Central Europe, it's an unequivocal reality that the best expression of the outcrop of the type rocks of this period is in that long yellow swathe that William Smith confidently painted running southwest to northeast, right across the centre of England. The conditions were not exactly similar during the millions of years of England's Jurassic. The seas were shallow and warm only across the very centre of the country. Elsewhere, the presence of huge land masses made critical differences. Two of these landmasses above all help shape the outcrop that William Smith mapped, and across which I was to make my short pilgrimage. The first, to the north, was a giant body of land called the North Sea Dome, which extended eastward to Russia and beyond, but in the west had spurs of high hills that ran across into Scotland and along the spine of what are now the Pennines. No Jurassic rocks, of course, were laid down there, since no sea was present in which the sediment might be suspended. And to the south was the second, a low island, 50 miles wide and oval-shaped, extending over what is now the Brittany Peninsula. The coastal seas that lay directly off these two land masses were, as one might suppose, muddier, less rich in oxygen, and very much shallower than those further away, and the Jurassic rocks that were laid down in them, and in the estuaries and sand flats that abutted them, were much less likely to be the thick-bedded limestones characteristic of oceanic conditions, and much more likely to be thinner and alternating layers of clay, silt, sand, limestone, clay, silt, sand, limestone, that are the inevitable consequences of the ebbs and flows at the oceanic edge. Which is precisely the case here in South Dorset. As I wound my way slowly northward from West Bay, the rocks that the fossil record insisted were of Middle Jurassic Age were a thin and confused mess of sediments. Evidently, they had been deposited in shallow seas and estuaries, in basins that had been subjected to frequent earthquakes and faults, uplifts and downthrusts, and in all cases the outcrops displayed the so-called rhythms of the cyclothems, with clays deposited where the waters had been deep, then bluish or yellowish sands as the waters began to recede, then limestones becoming progressively finer and finer-grained as the waters reached the climax of the ebb, and deposition came to a virtual end, after which the waters came flooding back, and with them the clays, the silts, and, as the shallowing began all over again, the sands and the limestones once more. Cyclothems are a feature of edge-of-ocean sediments, and Dorset has them in abundance. Along the outcrop the villages were adorned with stunningly pretty names. Solway Ash, Bradpole, Beminster, Melplash, Hazelbury Plunknet, Rhyme Intrinsica, Cheddington, East Coker, Mosterton, Netherbury. The countryside here was intimate, small-scale, constantly changing. The softer limestones had been eaten by the acid rains and formed little valleys. There were copses of pines growing in the sandy soil, where caps of sandstone overlay and protected mounds of shale, and roads passed deep into gorges of a soft brown sand that came away if you scratched the walls with a fingernail. The Jurassic rocks here had been given names that were almost as sonorous as the villages on which they lay. The Bridport Sands is perhaps a little prosaic, the Yellow Conglomerate a little less so, but what of the Wild Beds, the Red Bed, the Snuffbox Limestone, the Forest Marble, the Fuller's Earth, the White Sponge Limestone, the Scroff, and the Zigzag Bed? And if not magical names, then magical appearance. What could be better than the famously extraordinary outcrop found in a low cliff to the west of the old Coast Guard station at Langton Herring, which is 10 feet thick and made up of nothing less than a solid mass of crushed and flattened specimens of the famous Jurassic oyster, Ostrea acuminata. The village houses here in Dorset, most of them ancient, many of them thatched, twined with roses and huddled into cosy valleys, are generally built of limestone blocks that had been hauled from quarries some miles away, and which could not fairly be said to represent the mishmash of rocks below. This offers a sharp contrast to villages in the Cotswolds farther north, where the underlying Middle Jurassic is an inescapable feature of the architecture overhead. My grandparents had lived for a while in Simmonsbury, a pretty village lying a mile or so to the west of the main Jurassic track. Their house was built of Portland stone, an elegant building stone. St. Paul's Cathedral, the Ashmolean Museum, much of colonial Williamsburg is built of Portland stone, and which actually comes from near the top of the Upper Jurassic, close to its junction with the Cretaceous. I remember seeing in the old house walls traces of the biggest of all ammonites, the famously lumbering Titanites, which is a marker fossil for the Upper Jurassic. Someone also pointed out part of the internal cast of the shell of another odder beast, a small, long, conical, spiral-formed snail known as Aptyxiella, which vulgar quarrymen like to call a Portland screw. To the north of Crooker and in Somerset the Middle Jurassic rocks' lithologies begin to change. I was now leaving the rush and turbulence of the old cyclothemic shore and coming to a point where the seas, shallow but stable, were more oceanic than coastal, less disturbed, less turbid. The limestones become purer and thicker and more resistant here, both more resistant than the rocks back in Dorset, that are of the same age, and more significantly, more resistant than the rocks in Somerset, Gloucestershire, and Oxfordshire to the north, that are younger and which lie on top of them. Because of this, the outcrop of the Middle Jurassic everywhere north of the Dorset-Somerset boundary is marked by a sudden steep hill. As I travelled farther and farther north, so this hill and the very prominent edge where it rises up and away from the softer rocks below becomes ever steeper, more and more evident, more and more obvious. Small wonder that William Smith found the area around Bath the most congenial for his studies. Not only was it an attractive town, jammed with interesting personalities and lively minds, it was also happily sited at a place in the country's immense geological mosaic in which the Middle Jurassic rocks outcrop in a blindingly obvious way. The general line of their outcrop, which extends all the way north from Dorset to the Humber in Yorkshire, some 200 miles, is one of the great dividing lines of world geology, once seen, never forgotten. Around Bath, close to where a northbound traveller like me today, Smith two centuries before, first comes across it, it's stupendously memorable. On the western side of the line are the timid, milquetoast clays and weakling shales of the Lias of the Lower Jurassic. On the eastern side are the tough, thick, oolitic limestones of the Middle Jurassic. On the western side, the consequential scenery is all valley and marsh, river course and water meadow, lowing cattle, and in high summer a sticky, sultry heat. On the eastern side, underpinned by the limestone, everything has changed. There's upland plain and moor, high hills, high wind and flocks of sheep, and in winters fine white snows blowing on what can seem an endless and treeless expanse. And on the very line itself, at the point where England has dipped itself up gracefully to expose the limestone at its core, and to reveal the huge physical contrast between their hardness and the silky softness of the Lias clays below, is a long, high range of hills and cliffs. The line is, for the most part, an escarpment edge that rolls far to the horizon, separating vales and downlands from high plains and uplands. We see this line in scores of places. Down at the southern end of the country, the Bath end, we see it where Crickley Hill and Birdlip Hill rise hundreds of feet above the town of Cheltenham. We see it where Wootton-under-Edge, a village set on Lias clay, nestles below the village of Oldbury-on-the-Hill, which is on Middle Jurassic limestone. We notice it, we feel it, when we drop sharply down from it via a dangerously twisting switchback road, as we descend westward from the high plains of Snow's Hill, on the Middle Jurassic, to the antique shops of the clay valley town of Broadway, on the Lower Jurassic. We can see it unroll over a dozen miles if we drive along the traffic-clogged roadway of the A46, on the stretch between Bath and Stroud. On going north, everything visible to the left is Lower Jurassic clay that hunches low on the horizon. Everything to the right is Middle Jurassic limestone, and it rises high, its edge topped with oaks from which big black crows take in the view of the grassy fields below. We see the phenomenon exhibit itself over and over as we rumble northward across the land. We see it through central Gloucestershire and Warwickshire, through Rutland and Leicestershire, across Nottingham and Lincolnshire, so that when, a day or two after I had left the warmth of Dorset, I found myself in the cold of Lincolnshire, coasting along the A15 northbound from Lincoln, where there stands a fine Jurassic cathedral, made of just the same age limestone as that at Wells, down at the far southern end of the outcrop, to Scunthorpe, almost exactly the same held true. To my right rose high limestone plains, buffeted now by the North Sea winds, dotted with sheep, flat enough and suitably exposed for the building of great Royal Air Force runways, training schools and hangars. But to my left all was unsubtly different. A yellow cliff fell steeply away, and below it, spread out almost flat like an unfolded survey map, lay a long, low valley, thick with farms, populated and cosy. The Middle Jurassic formed the upland landscape to my right, the Lower Jurassic, the lowlands to my left. Seen today, this pikestaff plain exposition of how the rocks below make the hills above has the standing of a classic of English geology. Not a single guidebook to the geology of England fails to provide an illustration of the great hills at Crickley or Snow's Hill or the scarp face above the ancient wool town of Wootton-under-Edge. And, knowing now what William Smith had realized, explained and then coloured onto his great map when he saw this vast extent of hillside 2 centuries ago, it all seems far too easy. I find myself tempted to exclaim, as Thomas Huxley cried out on first reading Darwin, how very stupid not to have thought of that before. That William Smith was first to do so was a measure of the man's extraordinary achievement. To see what others could have seen but never did, to set down on paper what others might have suspected but never felt confident enough to declare. The rock type that appears most consistently across the hundreds of miles of the Middle Jurassic outcrop is invariably an oolitic limestone. The term comes from the tiny, fish-egg-like concretions of which the limestone is made, and which, in some of the coarser-grained oolites, can easily be seen with the naked eye. Under the microscope, the individual ooliths look like pearls or mother-of-pearl accretions, or those many-layered gobstoppers that English schoolboys once knew so well, and yet in place of the crystal of aniseed at the heart, there is in the case of the Cotswold ooliths a tiny piece of quartz or a fragment of shell. Layer upon layer of calcium carbonate have been deposited around this nucleus. Centuries of rubbing and jostling in Bahamas' warm blue seas then kept the slow-forming ooliths small and smoothly spherical, and their colour, freshly formed, has invariably either been carbonate white, or else, if there happened to have been more than the usual complement of dissolved iron in the waters of the time, reddish-brown. But hundreds of years of gentle weathering have changed all of England's Jurassic oolites into the mason's most magical building stone. The physical nature of the rocks alone has long rendered them a sculptor's dream. Their bedding planes are straight and well-defined, and either the chunks of quarried rock divide naturally into huge freestones, durable and massive and ideal for making big, strong, impressive buildings, or else they can be sawn into flat sheets of ashlar, which can be bonded to rougher rocks and give, less expensively, the same harmony and integrity of look and colour. Once in a while, relics of the old coral reefs are to be found, for Jurassic waters were blue and shallow, much like the Caribbean waters of today, and make for good building stone too. But they are knobby and ragged, and the quarrymen call them hardstone, and most locals think of them as less pretty than the oolites themselves. This Cotswold stone has a well-deserved and worldwide reputation. The stones are solid, easy to work, more than amenable to simple carving, perfect for bearing large loads. Above all else, though, the Cotswold stone is quite simply beautiful. The humblest of workmen's cottages, if fashioned from Cotswold oolite, is a lovely thing to see, and a huddle of the warm-looking Jurassic stone houses, clustered amicably in some river-carved notch in the meadows, can be so lustrously perfect, so quintessentially English, that seeing it brings a catch to the throat.